Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, when does press questioning turn into harassment? A reporter has been served notice by police for trying to question the subject of his story. Where should the line be drawn? Reporting the terrorist attack in Tunisia. How can the media cover terrorism in detail without lapsing into sensationalism? And do the papers risk doing the terrorists' PR for them? And making the traditional media hip for the youth of today. Martin Sorrell says that the press is now too stuffy and no longer connects with young people. What can be learned from the likes of Vice and BuzzFeed? And joining us as ever are two of the media's best and brightest. Ian Brimacombe is editor of World Update at the BBC World Service, and Kunal Dutta writes for Channel 4 and The Independent.
Media Focus.
So first up, a journalist has been issued with a police harassment notice for questioning a local woman who was convicted of fraud. Gareth Davies, who works for the Croydon Advertiser, approached the woman at her home and later sent her a single email. The reporter appealed the police notice, but it was rejected. Police complaints body, the IPCC, said Davies had continued to ask the woman questions after she'd made clear that she didn't want to take part in the story and that he had gone beyond what was reasonable. Ian, what do you make of this?
Well, full disclosure, Paul, I've signed the petition that's asked for this public information notice to be lifted, and I know a number of my colleagues have as well. I think, you know, as journalists, one of the most important things we do is to approach people involved with the stories that we're covering and ask them as assertively as we can for comment. I mean, I think, you know, throughout history, we've had examples of very pushy journalists breaking very important stories. You know, I don't think Bernstein and Woodward would have broken the Watergate scandal had they remained passive. They had to push and push and push. So it's an important characteristic, I think, of good journalism. I think, you know, another very important point is that he was asking Ms. Desai for a right to reply. Now, this was in her best interests. I think, journalistically speaking, this is one of the pillars of a journalist doing his job. So I think that has to be taken into account here. And the other important point, I think, is that he also had a duty to the public. You know, you have a story of a convicted fraudster who is alleged to have done various things. He wanted her side of the story, but he also wanted to know more about what she did, and it was in the public interest for that information to come out. So, to be honest, I think it's quite shocking that he's received this notice, and I think it should be lifted.
Do you think the police have made a kind of honest procedural mistake here in terms of overreacting, or do you think that this is the start of something perhaps more sinister?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell why the police have reacted as strongly as they have, and I think in particular, because it seems to me that Gareth Davies has said that he sent a single email and he approached her for a doorstep. And that, to me, seems like a very reasonable thing to do when you're covering a story.
Agreed.
You know, you've got her side of the story, which I think is that he was a little bit pushier. He sent her texts. He sent her, I think, additional emails. But he denies that. So I'm surprised that they've reacted as strongly as they have.
And do you think there's an argument that, you know, clearly it's not Woodward and Bernstein, is it, here? Although she is guilty of fraud, she appears to be quite a vulnerable lady. And although he has the perfect right to approach her for comment, he ought to have taken the first no for an answer.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. I think, you know, she has been convicted of a series of offences, and he was looking to provide as much information about the story that he was reporting as possible. And I think her side of that story was an important part of the story he was telling. So I think he was right if he says what happened is true, which is that he sent her an email requesting comment and he approached her at her home. That, to me, does not seem unreasonable.
Kunal?
Well, I think, yeah, I absolutely agree with what Ian says. I think also it's really important to look at the broader context of this. This is the post-Leveson phone hacking scandal world that we live in, and the pieces very much are in flux as to where the new lines lie. So what you have in this instance is another example of, I think it was the fact that when this reporter said to the police, I was only doing my job, apparently the police said that's what the journalist of News of the World said. Mm. So it's a very easy...
at the moment, inappropriate.
Absolutely. And it's a very easy response for them to fall back on, because the shock of the News of the World was so great, and it sort of changed our whole perception of how the press and the police work together. And I think this new climate that we're in is about delineating where those boundaries are. So possibly looking at it cold, what it feels like is that this is a police trying to reassert, you know, new boundaries and say that, you know, this sort of behaviour is not acceptable. But there is a problem there, because if you are effectively curtailing the democratic right to publish and challenge something, that's a new infringement of freedom that we should be weary of.
Do you think this reporter has the right to feel that kind of everyone's against him in all aspects of society? I mean, you've got the courts, you've got the police, you've got IPSO. It seems to me that they all seem to be aligning against the interests of journalists just getting on with their job. I mean, no one wants to be exposed by a journalist if you're doing the wrong thing, which means, of course, inquiries are going to be unwelcome. But that's the journalist's job, is it not?
That is a journalist's job, and we shouldn't forget that, you know, investigations, the very nature of them, they are uncomfortable. They do, you do need to take certain precautions and certain steps which might not be as palatable as those who are on the receiving end would like them to be. But this, I think, is why it's so important that this case is actually, you know, journalists do oppose it, is because it will set a new boundary as to, you know, where those new lines lie.
But do you think that, in a sense, it might be a good thing because it's brought into sharp focus the fact that this is going on? Ian mentioned he'd signed the petition. Do you think that the kind of fight back on this is actually going to, let people know, that the police know, they can't get away with this?
I think you will see more of this in the years to come as the press and the police try and sort of reassert their powers. As journalists, we need to be able to know that we can conduct investigations, but we will certainly conduct them in a way which has the sort of right levels of due diligence and is properly accountable. But equally, it's not afraid of, you know, holding a mirror to society and pointing out their flaws if we need to.
Ian, where do you think the line should be drawn in terms of the practicality? I mean, she obviously doesn't have an army of lawyers to protect her or a great big corporate law department. She's a person on her own. She's been convicted of fraud. You know, without trying to quantify it, how many attempts should a journalist make to ask someone to cooperate with their story before they have to take no for an answer?
I think it's very case specific. I mean, I think you have to assess the particularities of each story that you're covering. I do feel that, again, based on the evidence, I think Gareth behaved very reasonably. I even think he probably could have sent her a text or could have sent a follow-up email. I think, you know, obviously, if you're sort of hanging out outside their house and you're bothering them at work and it's clear that you're causing a degree of distress to the person, then it becomes something a little bit more complicated. But again, it's case by case. I do think there are clear lines. You know, Canal brought up these lines post-Levinson. Obviously, the phone hacking scandal itself really drew the extent to which celebrities are harassed, the extent to which their privacy is invaded. That's something that I think journalists have been guilty of. The most troublesome point at which I think something can become harassment is when you have grieving victims of a tragedy, and people, can overstep the line, in my opinion, when it comes to trying to get somebody to comment on something that's happened to a loved one. And I think that's the area in which I think a journalist covering a story really has to think very carefully about the approach, how they're going to try to get a comment from somebody, whether or not it's appropriate to approach a particular person, the timing of when you approach them, how you do it. All these things are very important. But again, I think it is case specific, and each individual case will have different considerations.
I mean, in a sense, what makes this interesting is that although she was clearly guilty of fraud, she was an individual woman, quite vulnerable as it seems. So in a sense, you know, if it was like the leader of a council or a member of parliament or a politician, I think you'd, as you said, context specifically, you would have the right to kind of doorstep them a bit more. It's a kind of par for the course, isn't it? But this is a private individual, albeit one found guilty of a crime.
But again, I do think, you know, along the grounds of her right to reply, I think he was thinking of her best interests when he was asking her for comment. She had the opportunity to tell her side of the story. And I think obviously he wanted that in his story because it made his story a better story. But at the same time, I think it was in her best interest. And again, I don't think he behaved unreasonably.
I mean, Canal, I work in PR. I'm always grateful when a journalist knocks on the door, even if our client's on the back foot, because it then gives us the opportunity to correct facts and engage. It's the attention that we want. You'd have thought she'd have welcomed it, actually, her chance to put her side of the story forward.
Well, yes. I would think that. I think with members of the public, particularly, she's been convicted for fraud and she's about to be sentenced. She probably has other things going on as well. So, you know, looking at it perhaps with a little bit more, I guess, empathy from her side. Perhaps it's a whole thing of, I have enough going on and I don't want to be sort of all over the papers as well. And that sort of, you know, that sort of internal psychological stress, there might be an argument for it. However, from what we've been told, the steps that were taken seem extremely above board. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a doorstep. A doorstep is, as Ian just pointed out, it's the way to get comment. If you can't get hold of someone, you know, we're told in writing for a national, if you can't get hold of someone on the phone, the actual right way to do it is actually go to their house
to
and make sure that you have actually properly covered off that base, not just put in a call 10 minutes before it's about to, the story's about to be published, you know, as part of a sort of standard process. So, you know, in that sense, the steps taken seem absolutely fine. Let's give her the benefit of the doubt. She tells the police she feels she's being harassed. The police to then issue this PIN, this harassment letter, which is actually, you know, designed for stalkers, feels a bit like
it's clearly an overreaction.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And what do you think's next for the police on this? Because clearly they ought to hear this message loud and clear that they've overstepped their mark here.
As I understand it, the IPCC has said that has backed them and said that their judgment is right in this case. So I think it's a case of, you know, fighting back. But as you go further up the chain of command, it becomes harder and harder to do that. It's just a matter of making sure these battles are fought each and every time they turn up. And particularly if you actually consider that we don't have a press complaints commission anymore, the new regulator is only in charge of a number of titles, not all of them. So this sort of battle for territory now is extremely important for how the press is regulated in the future. Mm. And making sure that it's not this sort of excessive use of state power when it doesn't need to be.
I mean, Ian, that is a relevant point, isn't it? It's particularly chilling that the IPCC have actually backed the police on this.
Absolutely. I mean, it does really seem, and if I was Gareth, I would feel, I mean, you brought up earlier that there almost appears to be you know, all these various levels of authority that are sort of conspiring against him. And it does certainly seem that these various bodies are making a point with him. You know, that's what, you know, Kunal mentioned earlier. This does seem to be sort of a post-Levinson point-scaring exercise, because the evidence just doesn't stack up, and yet you have, you know, a series of institutional bodies that are coming out against Gareth Davies.
I just wonder what would have happened if this was the reporting of a major national, you know, if it was the BBC or Channel 4 News or something like that. Would the police have been as quick to come back and say this is, you know, effectively a minor criminal offence if, you know, the report had been well known and they knew that they would have the weight of the national media fighting back on that decision?
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, it you know, to be honest, it came to my attention through a colleague who would, you know, just saw it on social media and said, you know, isn't this crazy? You know, this local reporter who's, you know, been completely stitched up. And you know, I couldn't really find it anywhere else. I mean, it had a little bit of traction online, but I think you're right that if this were sort of a much more high profile correspondent, there'd be a lot more talk in the, you know, in the mainstream press about what's going on. And it does appear as though they're sort of picking on him.
Yeah, and certainly the legal bodies inside those media organizations would have the courage to call this out and say it's, you know, it's ridiculous and fight that on behalf of the title, which I don't necessarily think the Croydon Advertiser might have access to. Mm.
So next up, a terrorist attack on a beach in Tunisia has led to the death of 38 people. In its aftermath, many papers featured exclusive photos of the terrorist. Critics have said that this approach risks turning our media brands into distribution channels for terrorist propaganda. Previously, papers have justified printing these images on the grounds that they need to educate their readers. Kunal, this is obviously a difficult balance. Where do you think the line lies?
Well, it's something that we've been sort of grappling with for the last year and a half. rise of ISIS and the way in which they have used social media video has given editors in this country a big headache. But it's also been a very interesting exercise. When the first ISIS beheading videos came out, there was a lot of sort of sensationalism and drama that was purposefully shot in the way it was, knowing that there would be an appetite for this in the West, which absolutely there was. And you saw the way in which, you know, Jihadi John became, even the name Jihadi John was part of this whole curation
of the myth of the legend.
Just of now we know just another deluded extremist that was growing up in Northwest London,
albeit now with a catchy name.
Well, and that was part of the problem. But what happened was, because we hadn't seen these sort of videos before, you know, you sort of think back to the days when Saddam Hussein would use state television to try and parade not even hostages, just people in his company. This is a whole new way of dealing with things. And when it first started, you know, the tendency was that the sheer shock and drama and the fact that we hadn't seen these sort of media used in this way, it was pretty much swallowed up here wholesale. I mean, a lot of those pictures were printed, you know, not the actual beheadings themselves, but, you know, the Guantanamo-clad Westerner on the floor, the knife-wielding extremist above. It was just all pretty much published. And gradually, editors became more and more aware that the more you did this, the more you were effectively just playing into the hands of terrorists. And that relationship has now, you see it now, it's completely changed. And I remember The Independent on Sunday did this famous front cover, which just had a blacked out front page with the words, "Here is the news, not the propaganda." And it was after the death of Alan Henning, where suddenly everyone became aware that, you know, publishing these photos was no longer acceptable.
I mean, Ian, it's a difficult balance to strike, because whether it be terrorists or whether it be kind of these upset teenagers in America that are going on shooting sprees, when you actually speak to psychologists and they're interviewed, they say it's the act of the spectacle in the media that they're trying to create, whether it be their terrorists or people shooting up a school. So you've got to try and balance the interests of making the story interesting, showing the horror of what it is, and frankly, you know, the more details you show, the better, the more viewers you're going to get, I would imagine, with also the fact that, you know, you don't want to encourage these people.
I think that's absolutely the case. And I think the fact that everybody is connected now and everybody can view material on their phones and they can view material on tablets and they share material is, a big part of the strategy, obviously. And this is, I think, one of the most dangerous realities is the fact that these guys have one object. Well, they have two objectives. The first objective is to terrorize people. And the second objective is to recruit people. And what they're doing fulfills those objectives, because in the social media sort of world and this digital world, even if it's horrific, it's sort of strangely fascinating. Mm. And I think that's the big part of the problem, is that people see this stuff, and even though it repels them, they want to share it with somebody because they can't believe how outrageous
it's gruesome.
It is.
It's a sense of the macabre.
Absolutely. And so this is the game they're playing. And so, you know, it's more essential than ever that journalists are hyper aware of what's going on. And I think, you know, Kunal said that this is absolutely the case now. I think most editors, most journalists are hyper aware of the propaganda and making sure that they're not falling into the trap of supporting that propaganda. And you know, the way that I think about it, you know, it's sort of maybe it's maybe not a spot on analogy, but, you know, we're constantly approached by people in PR who are trying to sell us something. And, you know, it's essential that we're considering, you know, the impact of what we're going to put on the air, but also how we can sort of take ownership of whatever it is that person is selling and make sure that we're presenting it in a way that we feel comfortable with. And this is a big part of how we report these sorts of atrocities, is the essential component that we don't lose editorial control of whatever is presented to us. You know, the other main things, obviously not being sort of a propaganda vehicle, but the other important factor, I think, is to be respectful to those who are featured in these videos and to consider them as you know, human beings first, with and kind of sort of recognize that human dignity and, you know, as I think, as Kunal said, you know, it's in some of the earlier incidents, editors were maybe too quick to sort of put images of these people in terrible situations. And I think subsequently we've had a different sort of attack in the reporting. And I know, like on our program, we did, we, you know, we spoke to people who would sort of celebrate their life. And, you know, I think with James Foley and with others, we sort of talked about all their great accomplishments and their achievements. So not sort of portraying them in that, you know, at their horrific end, instead sort of celebrating everything that they accomplished in life.
It must be a challenge for you, though, as a journalist and as an editor, because you want to create a compelling story. You have a piece of collateral, a video that could make it incredibly compelling, and you've got to resist using it out of respect for the victim and also not to encourage others. But how do you do that journalistically then, to create the interest and describe it and to kind of talk around it without actually showing it?
You know, as long as you are reporting what's happened, you treat it as you treat any other newsworthy story. You know, you've had you know, a terrible incident that's happened. It could be a plane crash, could be a bus crash. You know, you're gonna tell that story as respectfully as possible. Just because it comes, you know, along with these very sensational kind of images of something very dramatic happening, I think, you know, as long as you're telling the story in a way that presents that story, I think you should absolutely resist the need to sort of sensationalize it. And you know, again, I think it is those sort of three things you have to consider. The first, you know, this is the story of a human who is losing, a human or a group of people who are losing their lives, you know, or in a terribly distressing situation. So, you know, you need to be respectful to those individuals and their families. You know, you are also presented with effectively what is propaganda. And there is, you know, these groups have an aim that they want you to report this as they presented it to you because it suits their aims. And then the third thing is you need to maintain editorial control. So you need to make sure that whatever you do put out, you don't rush out because it's been packaged up and given to you. So I think more than ever we have to consider these things.
That's an interesting point, because if you actually think about it, ISIS have their own in-house media center, yeah. Right? And so every time you see this content that comes out, there's a black flag on it that says Al-Hayat Media Center, and you know then that you know, as a journalist news gathering, you know that this is legitimately from ISIS. So great for us, but not for just disseminating and putting online. And I think what we're seeing more of, that sort of content, you know, straight from their media center to us, it has this sort of grubby feel to it now. It's not the same as, you know, a year ago when this was so shocking and, you know, it provided these massive pictures for news bulletins or for newspapers. I don't think people feel that way anymore. I think we're more interested now in the sort of bigger context of ISIS and what happens now, rather than this sort of,
I think we've learned the trick,
short,
right?
Yeah, like, short-term, you know, short shock factor.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. We've sort of be as editors, as journalists, we sort of understand the game that they're playing, and it's much easier now for us to kind of pick and choose. We also, I think, are more aware that the audience is increasingly horrified by the levels of violence with which you know, these people are operating. And I think that sort of helps us to take decisions, because we don't want to be showing images of people drowning in a cage, you know, presented in this sort of pseudo game show scenario, you know, because it's unbearably horrific. And it's sort of, it's a race to the bottom. I mean, certainly, you know, the other thing is, certainly, I mean, it is a gore fest. They're aware of it. We're aware of it. The audience is aware of it. You know, we have to take these editorial decisions and decide what is a responsible thing to do. And if it's ghoulish and horrible, maybe we don't have to show the horrors of what's going on out there. Maybe we just tell people what's happened, but we don't have to illustrate it. I mean, that's, you know, a really important, I think, development. As you say, then, you know, in the early days, we were sort of a little bit caught off guard. But I think now we're certainly sort of across it.
There's one interesting exception to that. And I think that's the, with the recent events in Tunisia, what you're seeing, you know, every day, and you see this with a big news event like this, is that this user-generated content, as it's called, so mobile phone footage, doesn't usually come out straight away with, you know, within minutes of the occurrence. It filters out over time.
Trickles out over a few days,
yeah,
doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. But what's really interesting about it is that it really tells you other stories. So this isn't coming out of, you know, ISIS headquarters. This is the, you know, the guy who happened to be in a hotel bar or standing around as a security guy, but happened to have a phone and was, you know, and we actually could see him running, following the gunman onto the beach, and this sort of extraordinary story of bravery, you know, the sort of local Tunisian people running towards this guy, putting themselves in great danger in order to help and save British people.
And to mitigate the loss of life.
Yeah, and so you're running and you're seeing these shots of the beach and you're really caught up in the moment, but it is a story of guts and heroism, and it deserves to be told.
And that's a really important distinction is between that sort of footage and that sort of material where you're documenting something that's happened. And obviously the other, you know, the rules that we discuss about being respectful and that sort of thing need to apply to how you use that stuff, but it's very different to the propaganda that's being produced and sort of presented to the media. If it's material that's being gathered at the time and it's useful material in telling the story and you can present it in a respectful manner, then I think, you know, we're using as much of that as we can, really.
And do you think, though, in the 24-hour rolling news media that we have now, do you think time's a factor? Because, you know, I've seen several instances of this where the first time it's broken on BBC News Channel or Sky News, it's not that, you know, the identities of the victims are not pixelated, and then an hour later they've managed to start to pixelate it and so on and so forth. I mean, it must be quite difficult not only to make the right decision, but also in that sense of urgency that you've got to get it to air as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. It's very, very difficult, and we have strict guidelines. We have procedures in place, and you know, producers are meant to be across these guidelines. You know, we're, as you say, a 24-hour operation. We have people coming off shifts. We have handovers, and when big things are happening during those transitions, the reality is that's when things slip through. But I think, you know, I think the BBC for the most part gets it right. I think other broadcasters are aware of these sensitivities. And you know, it's just important that when you're working for an organization like that, everybody's sort of up to speed on the latest policy on whatever we're meant to be doing.
And certain alarm bells will always ring off if you see any picture of any dead person. Immediately, it's like, who is this? You know, why are we showing this? What is the actual sort of public interest argument? Is it strong enough to actually warrant us showing it? The minute you see a corpse, it's usually has to really justify being in footage. Otherwise, there's no real need for it. There's nothing that can't be told.
And finally, Sir Martin Sorrell has said that the traditional media is too stuffy and no longer resonates with younger people. He used the BBC, The Guardian and The New York Times as examples of papers that were failing to engage young people and said that this was actually a question of style. Sorrell argued that young people were moving to newer websites with a different approach, like the gonzo journalism site Vice, which Sorrell partly owns. Ian, do you think Sir Martin has a point?
Well, I think there's no question that web brands, digital brands like Vice, like Vox, like BuzzFeed, have really captivated a younger audience and have kept their interest in a way that that some of the other brands certainly didn't a couple of years ago. I think things are changing. But, you know, I think the reason these new brands have been so successful is because they have, I mean, they're effectively startups. They've been able to come up with an idea, an approach, a design, and they've gone for it. They know who their audience is. They understand the language that their audience speaks, so they're speaking directly to them. These brands have been very quick to understand the value of social media and mobile and how people are consuming news. So they've built platforms, digital platforms that sort of serve that really effectively. They haven't had the problems that the traditional brands have had, which is that they're these existing brands that need to adapt to a new environment. And that obviously takes time. It requires, you know, it's like turning a ship. So I think certainly in the early days, I think a lot of the big brands were on the back foot. I'd say that they've made some pretty impressive strides to sort of address that in the past couple of years. And, you know, I think the New York Times, The Guardian, the BBC, all these big brands now produce content that young people are enjoying. And they're certainly much better at distributing that content online, which was a big part of the problem in the early days, is just, you know, going to the platforms that people were already on, like Twitter, like YouTube, Facebook, that sort of thing, and sort of reaching them on their platforms instead of expecting people to come to them. So there have been, you know, I think some important changes in that respect. I think Sorrell certainly has a point, but I think the old media brands are catching up.
Canal?
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd just say that my own personal belief is that while, you know, Martin Sorrell's in Cannes and a little bit loose tongue, I think he did take it back once or twice and say perhaps stuffy is
he
the wrong word.
Stuffy.
But, you know, I'll just pose the question, what's going to happen when the BuzzFeed readership grows up? What happens when the Vice readership grows up? As the world gets more complicated, as political issues become more intertangled and the world becomes smaller, the so-called sort of listicle culture of BuzzFeed is going to have to change. It is changing. It's made massive changes in the States. They've recently, in the UK, hired Janine Gibson, who was the deputy editor of The Guardian, which is a massive hire and a massive statement about where the future of digital journalism is. But I wouldn't rule out as well the moves that, as Ian mentioned, Channel 4 News, The Guardian, The Economist recently launched a film unit, Economist Films, with a view to bringing their once, you know, 800-word columns into film. And that's part of the whole new challenge of how to curate content effectively for audiences as the medium changes.
So, Ian, do you think that, you know, there's these, to use your analogy, there's these huge, great, big, hulking ships, which is the old media. Do you think that they are going to be able to change in time? Or do you think it would be better to try and, rather than kind of make some cosmetic changes to the ship, you just, you know, as you suggested, start again and build a smaller ship that's more agile?
When you have big organizations, the advantage is that you can sort of hive off parts of them to work on, you know, different audiences, different priorities. And I think you're seeing that certainly at the BBC. And I think you're also seeing it at the New York Times and The Guardian, where you have almost little sort of startups within these organizations.
Incubator units
yeah. that are trying out, you know, new products, trying out new approaches, you know, different ways of filming, different presenters. And then the stuff that sticks, the stuff that works and is popular on social, they then, you know, start to promote that stuff and make it, you know, a little bit, we'll just get, allow it to have a bit more clout. So I think that's the approach. And you know, there have been a few examples where I think that's worked. I mean, on my program, for example, we're a conventional radio program on the surface, but we produce a podcast. And we've started producing a product, which is a weekly YouTube video, where we do an interview with a different photographer each week. And we cut the studio footage of the interview with a series of photos. What we found very, very heartening is that we've promoted it on YouTube and on social media, Facebook and Twitter for the most part. And the analytics tell us that our audience is principally you know, young women between the ages of about 20 and 25. Now, our conventional radio program, the main program that we produce, World Update, most of the listeners to that program are, say, between the ages of, you know, 40 and 60.
So you're reaching out to new people.
Well, we're reaching out to new people. And it's the same presenter doing the same interviews, the same sort of content.
Different channel.
We're rerunning the material on the radio as well. But what's clear is because we've gone to YouTube, we are getting young people consuming our content. We're getting great comments. We're getting lots of clicks. So it's working.
The Independent's done a similar sort of strategy of...
With the eye.
Yeah, with the eye, exactly. So you have the main book, The Independent, which is still, you know, as sort of hard-hitting world agenda, everything that the sort of brand has...
Engage your brain before reading kind of thing.
Yeah, completely. But what's been really interesting is in developing the I newspaper, that's largely sort of content that is scaled down, but it's the same theme.
It's not dumbed down, is it? I agree.
Not at all.
It's a great paper, actually. It's very accessible.
That's largely the feedback seems to have been that. It's the fact that, you know, I can actually know what's going on around the world in parts of the world that I didn't otherwise know, but I know it and for, you know, all for 40p and reading it in 40 minutes, which has done quite well. And then similarly, that content can also be curated even shorter on i100, which is their digital product, which seems to be doing better among younger audiences who are, you know, clicking and sharing, and that new currency of sharing content rather than actually sort of buying papers seems to be working in that way.
Well, gentlemen, we've run out of metaphorical tips, sadly. So it's at this point that I invite you to do your bit of self-promotion where people can follow you on Twitter and let me know your website addresses and so on. So, Kunal, should we start with your good self?
You can find me on tweeting at my name, which is Kunal Dutta. Funny you should mention website. I just launched one today, thinking if I'm going to be a multimedia journalist, I should actually be able to build my own website. And that's www.kunaldutta.com. And I write in The Independent, the iNewspaper, and Channel 4 News, as well as other places.
So, Ian, how do we tune into your show? How do we listen to the podcast?
You can search on any search engine for World Update Daily Commute. That's our podcast. And you can find our host, Dan Damon, on Twitter. He's at BBC Dan Damon. And my personal Twitter is at iBrim.
And for those that want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Paul W.R. Blanchard. And don't forget, you can go to the website, mediafocus.org.uk, and leave your email address in the box and receive a shiny update once a fortnight, letting you know when the new podcast is out. But that's it for this fortnight. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'm Paul Blanchard. The associate producer was Jordan Greenway. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!